Israeli policy at one, and secondly, this particular ambassador who actually says there is no such a thing as Palestinians. Every inch of the land belongs to the Israelis. So by that definition means that this is encouragement to ethnic cleansing.
Once again, an expression of solidarity for Palestinians portrayed as anti-Semitism. One of the targets of that labeling, the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission himself, who has spent a lifetime calling out the Israeli regime's repressive apartheid against Palestinians.
What do? They actually try to be sort of racist towards others, use the only tool that they could possibly use of saying anti-Semitic, and then sort of trying mud at everybody else who's trying to stand up for justice and say, this is standard, this type of person should not be given a voice. If you look at genocide and ethnic cleansing, it always starts by denying people of their right to live where they are living.
It's a curious thing about freedom of speech and of expression in the UK. While it's free against some, it's restricted against others. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bakhari Khani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK foreign ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa, via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We will be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The birth of the Holy Prophet, the beginning of a new era in human life. This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24th, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad, upon his pure, immaculate household, upon his chosen companions, and upon the followers until the Day of Judgment. I welcome all of you, dear participants, particularly the honorable guests, who have come for the Islamic Unity Conference, and the brothers who have come to this meeting from other countries. I would like to congratulate you on this auspicious anniversary of the birth of the esteemed Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, and also the blessed anniversary of the birth of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, which took place in the year 83 of the Hijri calendar, on the same day that the Holy Prophet was born. The birth of the Holy Prophet was in fact the beginning of a new era in human life. It was a sign of the beginning of a new era of divine will and divine favors for humanity. Therefore, this birth is a very great event. The greatness of the birth of the Holy Prophet truly cannot be described in ordinary words. This is a very big incident.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Some people have described it in the language of art and poetry, which is one way of portraying this event. One example of such poetry is the following. Guidance was born, so the world was lit up, and smiles and admiration settled upon the lips of time. The language of art speaks in this way. Guidance was born. Light rained upon the universe. The lips of time opened with a smile and praise. The greatness of this incident can be understood to a certain extent with such descriptions. This is an important event. The greatness of the event of the birth of the Holy Prophet equals the greatness of his status. His great status in creation is such that from the beginning to the end of creation, the exalted God has not created another being as great as the Holy Prophet. The responsibility that God placed on his shoulders is just as great. Because of this great responsibility, God says, Allah did confer a great favor on the believers when he sent among them an apostle from among themselves. Quran, Surah 3, verse 164.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. A New York Times report reveals how the U.S. military bombed civilians in Syria and then bulldozed the site to try to cover up the news. A 500-pound bomb was dropped on mostly women and children. Then it was followed by two more bombs, taking care of any survivors. At the end, at least 80 people were killed. The U.S. says 16 of them were fighters and four were civilians, and they did not bother to even try to describe who the others were. However, they had decided to sit on the news of this act to try to avoid being accused of committing a war crime. Stay with us as we take a look at this event on this Spotlight.
It's March 18th, 2019. An American F-15 drops a 500-pound bomb on a crowd of women and children in an area near the town of Baghouz in Syria's Deir ez-Zor province. Minutes later, another warplane drops an even bigger bomb, then another, killing the few survivors of the first strike. The initial death toll was put at 70. Fast forward to November 2021. The U.S. Central Command has acknowledged that 80 people were killed in the strikes. While claiming that 16 of the victims were Daesh terrorists, it admits that it's unclear if the rest were civilians. CENTCOM has also defended the attacks as justified and conducted in self-defense, arguing that the targeted women and children could have been combatants. But investigations carried out by the New York Times provide a different account of the incident. According to the Times, a U.S. Air Force lawyer who oversaw the operation believed he had witnessed possible war crimes and notified the authorities. The Pentagon later carried out an independent inquiry into the incident, but the Times says the subsequent report was, quote, stripped of any mention of the bombing. The newspaper also says the reports were delayed and classified, and the attack site was bulldozed shortly after.
So this is one piece that is coming out, very important, because it shows just how criminal the war is and the cover-up that takes place at every level, even when within the army, those who saw it and have access tried to bring it to light and instead were dismissed.
The report bore a striking resemblance to a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul in late August this year that claimed the lives of 10 members of the same family, including 7 children. The U.S. military initially said it had targeted a Daesh terrorist planning a suicide attack in the wake of the bombing at the Kabul airport that had killed 13 U.S. troops and dozens of Afghan civilians 3 days before. The Pentagon similarly defended the Butch strike as a, quote, righteous one.
Daniel Hale, the former U.S. Air Force intelligence analyst who worked with the NSA, who worked with JSOC, is now going to be spending the next 45 months in prison for having let the world know that 90% of the victims of U.S. airstrikes are innocent bystanders, basically civilians.
To put things into perspective, the United States conducted about 1,000 airstrikes in Syria and Iraq in 2019 alone, using over 4,700 bombs and missiles. The official civilian toll for the entire year is 22.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight. William Jones, an executive intelligence review out of Leesburg, Virginia. And Danny Shaw, author and international affairs analyst out of New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us on this spotlight. Let's start this off with William. I mean, why has it taken almost 3 years for this news to be exposed? I mean, there had been people in the area who were eyewitnesses, as well as the central command in Qatar, that watched the whole event via drone footage. So why did it take so long?
Well, this was obviously a major cover-up. We don't know how often this happens. I mean, the fact that there was a whistleblower here and this has been revealed probably indicates that there are maybe dozens more of such incidents that are never reported. It was a tremendous operation, so many people who were killed in this, a tremendous mistake on many, many levels. And then it was increased by a conscious attempt to bury it. And this is which is the bigger crime. The death of the individuals, of course, is the most horrendous. But the fact that this can occur without oversight condemns the entire war operations that the United States is conducting in this region. And it also points out the fact that the United States war in Syria is a serious breach, a serious crime of itself, because if they had been working with the Syrian government, which they're fighting against, they could have revealed already what the problem was, what was the situation on the ground, and this would have never occurred. But the fact that the United States has placed itself in opposition to the legitimate government of Syria is really the basic problem that we're dealing with here, leading to this tragedy.
Danny, why do you think the New York Times has actually revealed this news? I mean, as William said, there are so many incidents that probably take place and go about with little or no reporting, especially in the corporate media. Your assessment of that?
Well, as if we needed more proof that to the U.S. military-industrial complex, Syrian lives do not matter, Kurdish lives do not matter, Palestinian, Iranian, Iraqi, Afghan lives do not matter. Why is it taking 3 years for this to come to light? How many other similar incidents with all of the drones and bombs the U.S. is piloting from Somalia to Yemen to the invisible bombs that they drop every day on the Venezuelan people, on the Cuban people, now rejuvenated sanctions against the Nicaraguan people. The U.S. has no right to be in Syria in the first place. So hopefully this sparks these important conversations about Syrian self-determination. No one has endured more suffering than the Syrian people in their struggle against Daesh. And as it's become very clear, Daesh has powerful, powerful international backers. This has never been a civil war in Syria. It's been an internationalized conflict with the Saudis and the Turks, and of course, the largest imperialist overlord, the U.S., backing any anti-Assad, any anti-Syrian Arab army forces that they can.
Well, William, the U.S. military authorities say that 16 of those killed out of 80 were fighters. And even if they are correct, how can they justify killing so many women and children? And if they didn't know when they dropped the first bomb that there were civilians there, why did they drop a second and a third?
Well, this is a very good question. I mean, the New York Times has a lot of details on this, the fact that the people who were calling in these bombs were a very, very secret operation. And many of the monitors that existed, including one of the cameras, one of the high-resolution cameras that were looking at it, was not available to them. And but they had the authority to call in this tremendous operation, allegedly only to be done if they were under fire, which, of course, was not the case here. So there was a tremendous breach of even the rules of war as is understood by the American military, and it may very well amount to war crimes. That a court, I think, will have to decide on that. But it's just really gotten out of control. The whole war situation has gotten out of control. And if the U.S. continues in this direction, you're going to have many more things like this. But I think that now that whatever the reasons were for the New York Times to reveal this thing, it was surprising for me that they did it and not somebody else, I think will lead to a major investigation, not only of this specific incident and not only of the rules of war as we know it today, but also will call into question the very commitment that the U.S. has made to fight against the legitimate regime of Assad in Syria. And perhaps there will be a reaction against this whole kettle of fish that has been built up by the military outreach and extended operations of the United States worldwide.
Well, William, just staying with you, because you just talked about not sure why the New York Times revealed it as they had, because that was my previous question, why did they do it? But now that they have, do you think perhaps that we are entering a type of transition, perhaps some type of reckoning, that actually the mainstream media is willing to critically look at what has taken place and what is continuing to take place in Syria?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that, knowing the mainstream media. In this instance, I probably suspect that the people who were involved in exposing this, who actually presented the information also to a congressional committee, and we're not getting a whole lot of response from them, also felt that by going public, they would get that response. Things would start to move. And, of course, they went to the New York Times, and I don't think the New York Times is going to let a story like this go when they can make some hay out of it and make also profit out of that. But I don't think there's been a main change in the mainstream media. They go along to get along, and the change has got to come elsewhere. It's got to come from the American people, and it's got to come from the American people putting pressure on their congressmen to stop this war. We know the situation generally President Biden got out of Afghanistan, because there's a general mood not to be in the war-fighting business here in the United States. And that mood has got to make itself felt among the legislators if we're ever going to avoid problems like we see in this incident.
Okay.
So I don't think there should be a change there, but I think there is a tremendous change in the public mood against this type of war-fighting, policeman-like operations that the U.S. has been conducting over the whole world.
Well, Danny, there was an investigation, an incident, but it was internal. Now, if U.S. forces thought that their attacks were actually justified, why did they bulldoze the area then to try to hide the evidence?
Yeah, it's like the NYPD or any police department investigating themselves. We could never trust that investigation. It should be the Syrian authorities, the just authorities of the region who investigate. Certainly when the entire area was bulldozed, that is very telling. It does come as a type of shock that it was the New York Times, one of the main mouthpieces of the military-industrial complex. The New York Times, together with the Washington Post and CNN, the whole gamut of liberal, neoliberal media, has always beat the drums of war, bombs away on Yugoslavia, bombs away on Panama, bombs away on Libya, nothing but unfettered aggression against Syrian self-determination. But within these mainstream corporate media complex, you are going to have certain critical voices. Perhaps this was going to be leaked somewhere else. So, as William said, the Times got ahead of it so they could cash in on what is more Syrian suffering.
Well, William, one of the Air Force's lawyers, Lieutenant Colonel Dean Corsack, believed that he had witnessed a war crime and tried to tell higher authorities, but nothing happened except that he was sidelined. And, I mean, we have seen whistleblowers, especially in dealing with the military-industrial complex, paying a major, major price. But the actual problem is really never addressed. Your take on this?
Well, it seems to me that there's an issue here of why this attack was called for in the first place. And according to the rules of war, it could be done only if the people calling it were in danger, and that doesn't seem to be the case now. But you've had them bending the rules a lot in this respect. And by bending the rules, they probably got to a point where they actually broke the rules. And we'll have to figure out if there was culpability on the part of the people involved in this thing, and that
well,
it was
a... Well, let me just jump in here. You say bending the rules, William, but even according to what you said earlier, which of course is true, I mean, the U.S. being there is actually illegal, right? Because the sovereign government never invited them in. So... do you think that basically rules here are as the Americans create them as they go? Because if we start from the first point of it, it's illegal for them to even be there.
That's correct. That is the fundamental the fundamental crime here is the war in Syria, in which we are actually supporting groups that would ordinarily be called terrorists because they're in opposition to President Assad, and we are also opposed to the Assad regime. That is the primary problem, that it's a legitimate government that was elected by the people. They're conducting the operations of the country, and we're trying to conduct a revolution against them in the operations in Syria. That's the primary crime, but there are also two other issues here. Was there a crime, even according to the rules of war for the United States conducted in this particular incident? And more specifically, there must have been a crime. There was probably even a greater crime in covering it up, because the cover-up itself can be an illegal matter which will lead to jail time. Obviously, somebody will get fired, but could even be jail time for people who perpetrated the cover-up. And I think that's what we're going to see moving forward. And I think this is going to be very much in the public view. And I think that will be very useful to teach the American public about what's actually going on.
But at the end of the day, William, sorry to jump in. At the end of the day, if anyone pays, what we have seen in the past is usually that it's some low-level military personnel that actually ends up paying the price. Never the higher-ups, the general or whomever gave the actual order. I mean, we have seen that time and time again, that those who are mostly responsible for these crimes never pay a price.
That's absolutely right. And I think the problem is that the American citizenry have got to become much more enraged about this thing in order to force a change of policy and to hold those responsible who have been responsible for war crimes. And it's not simply the soldiers on the ground who are carrying out orders. It's the people who are giving the orders in a war that is unjustified, that is illegal, and that is itself a crime against humanity.
Well, Danny, in general, why aren't these cases like this taken more seriously? Because if they're not investigated, excuse me, and the right people actually punished, then it's going to be repeated time and time again. Are lives in this region of the world less important for the American military?
That's 100% correct. I mean, what is legality to the U.S. unipolar hegemon? They could care less about international law. They trample over this paper law and mock it all day, every day, across the world, in every continent, in every ocean. How many hundreds and hundreds, 800 plus U.S. military bases stationed around the world to patrol and surveil and invade and occupy the sovereignty of any country on earth? As William has said, the underlying sin, the original crime, is the invasion, the occupation. Why is there one U.S. troop in Syrian territory? It's such an incredible double standard. They would never allow one Cuban soldier or one Syrian soldier within the U.S.'s territorial boundaries. And what we've continually seen, when there are brave whistleblowers, they go after these whistleblowers, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, with everything to send a clear message to the everyday Americans and GIs in the military, don't you dare raise your voice, or we'll put you in a box, we'll lock you up, we'll put you away forever, striking fear into how many young people who actually want to do the right thing. So when has the military brass, when have the West Point graduates, the generals, ever done a day in jail, been court-martialed? And the true war criminals, from Obama to Bush to Trump to whoever's in the Oval Office right now, it's bipartisan. These are war criminals on both sides of the aisle, and they need to be held responsible. But it will never be the New York Times. It will never be this system that holds the war criminals responsible. It has to be a mass movement in the streets. And hopefully this can be a teachable moment so that more young people join this anti-imperialist movement.
Well, William, again, if these crimes are not paid for, the situation would obviously just be repeated. I mean, we saw in Afghanistan just a few months ago when Americans bombed a house and killed 10 civilians, including 7 kids. At first, Washington reported it was an attack on Daesh, and then it was forced to admit that it had killed civilians. And so far, nothing has been done. No compensation, nothing, although the U.S. gave some verbal commitments. And, of course, these people's lives cannot be returned either way. So shouldn't there be more severe punishment? And if it's not going to come from within, what needs to be done? What kind of system needs to be set up to hold them responsible?
Well, you know, the United States and President Biden is always harping on the so-called rule of law. When he's talking about Russia, he's talking about China. Obviously, there should be a rule of law which is beneficial for the population. And now that it's on the table, I think other countries as well will be talking about how must the world operate? How must countries work together in order to create better situations for their citizenry? I think that you'll see on the international scale an attempt to maybe not legislate, but at least to create a framework of legislation for how countries have to act how they have to act if they have to go to war, and how they can stop going to war. But I think also in the country, as your other speaker said, there is a reaction from the American people, and it's a very divided country at the moment, and I think people will be out on the streets demanding change at the highest levels of this type of policy making, which they've just become tired of.
Well, Danny, just 1 minute we have left. Do you think the only guarantee for the safety of the people in this region is that the U.S. must leave Western Asia?
No question. U.S. out of the Middle East, the U.S. out of Asia, the U.S. out of the Caribbean, the U.S. out of every territory that they've invaded. How many coups post-World War II? How many coups, how many illegal invasions and occupations and drone bombings in the last century plus? But every dog has his day. None of these generals, none of these statesmen are invincible. The sun set on the British Empire and the Tsarist Empire. It will soon set on U.S. imperialism, the most powerful, arrogant empire in human history, so that at last the world's people can breathe in peace and get this imperial knife out of their neck.
And with that note, I appreciate both of you being with me. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review out of Leesburg, Virginia, and Danny Shaw, author and international affairs analyst out of New York. And we appreciate you being with us on the spot on the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The U.S. government is begging the British High Court to allow Julian Assange to be extradited to the United States. Doing so would be a human rights disaster, given that American prisons violate the most basic human rights of political prisoners like Assange. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Chip Gibbons, writer. This article is published under the heading, Julian Assange's extradition to the United States would result in serious human rights violations. Stay tuned for more. For 2 days, British prosecutors, acting on behalf of their U.S. counterparts, urged the U.K. High Court to overturn a judge's decision blocking Julian Assange's extradition to the United States. Although the United States indictment against Assange is a textbook example of a political offense, which are traditionally immune from extradition, the judge rejected Assange's press freedom claims. Instead, she found that given the conditions of U.S. prisons and Assange's mental state, his extradition would place the journalist at risk of suicide. In seeking to rebut this ruling, the U.S. and U.K. prosecutors' sadism was on full display. British prosecutors engaged in character assassination of an eminent psychiatrist who they themselves have used as an expert and implied Assange could not be suicidal or severely mentally ill as he regularly watched television in the afternoon. The proceedings also turned on the validity of U.S. assurances that Assange would receive humane treatment in U.S. prisons. Not only are these assurances filed with troubling holes, but even the highest standard of treatment, as outlined by the United States for Assange, would likely amount to torture. This is hardly surprising, given how the United States has treated whistleblowers and others accused of giving information to the media in prison. Given the United States' miserable track record in treating political prisoners like Assange, and prisoners more generally, it's clear that a successful extradition of Assange to the United States would result in grievous violations of human rights. Much of the United States assurances deal with the potential for Assange to be subject to special administrative measures, that is, SAMS, or be placed in the administrative maximum facility in Florence, Colorado, that is, ADX Florence, a supermax prison, two prospects that alarmed a UK district judge so much that she blocked extradition. The Center for Constitutional Rights has described SAMS as the darkest corner of the U.S. federal prison system, combining the brutality and isolation of maximum security units with additional restrictions that deny individuals almost any connection to the human world. SAMS include both physical and social isolation. Prisoners subjected to SAMS are already in solitary confinement. SAMS forbid prisoners from communicating at all with other prisoners. Only approved family members and lawyers may speak to someone under a SAM, and these calls are monitored by the FBI. A successful extradition of Assange to the United States would result in grievous violations of the human rights. The SAMs apply not only to the prisoner, but impose gag orders on those that are approved to speak with them, including lawyers. Prisoners subject to SAMs are restricted in what information they can receive from the outside world, with prison officials being allowed to censor periodicals about current events. SAMs are reserved for national security and terrorism cases. Assange has stated he thinks he may be subject to them. Joshua Scott, the accused source for WikiLeaks' Vault 7 revelations, has been subject to SAM since October 2018. Scott maintains he's not the Vault 7 source and told officials that whoever was should be executed. In March 2020, a jury failed to reach a verdict on the Espionage Act charges against him. The government is seeking to retry Scott, and he remains in jail, subject to SAMs, in solitary confinement, and not allowed to go outside after over 3 years. The United States has not guaranteed Assange will not be subject to SAMs. Instead, they have assured that Assange would only be subject to SAMs if, after he was extradited to the United States, he committed an action that warranted imposing them. This is hardly reassuring. The discretion to impose SAMs rests with the Attorney General, and the way attorneys general have imposed sums is arbitrary, without any due process. Sums cut off not only defendants but their attorneys from communicating with the media, a long-time goal of the United States and others when it comes to Assange. In blocking extradition, the district judge decided that if convicted, Assange would likely be sent to ADX Florence. In this prison, inmates are confined to their cells for 23 hours a day. In the 8-by-12-foot cells, everything, including the furniture, is made of concrete. Like with the SAMs, the United States has offered assurances about ADX Florence that are full of holes. The United States assures Assange would not be held there unless after entry of this assurance, Assange was to commit any future act that then meant he met the test for such designation. While the assurances are hardly reassuring, what is equally troubling is Assange's fate, even if the assurances are kept. In a declaration to British courts, Assistant U.S. Attorney Gordon Cromberg asserted that if Assange is brought to the United States and subjected to pretrial detention, he will most likely be held at the William G. Trousdale Alexandria Adult Detention Center in Alexandria, Virginia. Cromberg claimed there is no solitary confinement at the Alexandria Detention Center before he described in detail the jail's protective custody and administrative segregation housing units. Inmates in protective custody are not allowed to interact with other inmates. Inmates in administrative segregation, according to Cromberg declaration, are kept in their cells 22 hours a day. British prosecutors rejected the claims that holding a person by themselves in a cell for 22 hours a day constituted solitary confinement. To make this point, they drew on Cromberg's statements that inmates in administrative segregation are able to speak to one other through the doors and windows of their cells, and that inmates in administrative segregation can meet with lawyers. The United States claims, as parroted by British prosecutors, that Assange would not face solitary confinement are patently absurd. The United Nations Standard Minimum Rules for the Treatment of Prisoners define solitary confinement as 22 hours or more a day without meaningful human contact. Under the Mandela Rule, solitary confinement in excess of 15 consecutive days constitutes prolonged solitary confinement. Two successive UN special rapporteurs on torture have stressed that prolonged solitary confinement violates international human rights law and can very likely amount to torture. This is especially the case when inflicted on prisoners like Assange with pre-existing mental health problems. The United States' own description of administrative segregation offered to the UK government meets the standard for solitary confinement under international law, given that Assange is almost certainly likely to spend more than 15 days in jail awaiting trial. Assange's treatment under the United States' own assurances would constitute torture under international law. And Assange would not be the first person charged under the Espionage Act to be held in Alexandria Detention Center, meaning we already have a glimpse at the cruelties that await him. At least three whistleblowers have been held at Alexandria Detention Center. It is where Chelsea Manning was held when she refused to testify before the WikiLeaks grand jury. Similar to Cronberg's declaration, Manning's jailers claim she was not in solitary confinement, which does exist at their facility, but administrative segregation. Manning was kept alone in her cell for over 22 hours a day and was only allowed to leave between the hours of 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. Although Manning was removed from solitary after public pressure, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture still found the U.S. government had tortured her. This was the second time a UN Special Rapporteur on Torture had made such a finding. In 2012, when Chelsea Manning was court-martialed for giving WikiLeaks the documents at the heart of the Assange indictment, her pretrial detention in a military jail was found to be constituted cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and torture. CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling described his own time at the Alexandria Detention Center in harrowing detail. Sterling recalled being placed in a holding cell with numerous other detainees. "We were packed in like so much garbage, sleeping on the floor and having to use an open toilet before being moved to a special cell block that also housed Zacharias Mosini, convicted of involvement in 9/11 attacks." According to Sterling, his time in this unit was in solitary confinement, and he would spend days on end without being let out of cell. Drone whistleblower Daniel Hale was also recently imprisoned at the Alexandria Detention Center. After pleading guilty to one account of violating the Espionage Act, Hale was initially released on his own recognizance. But after a therapist reported Hale as suicidal, Hale was ordered taken into custody, allegedly for his own mental health. Such a move is perverse on numerous levels. As Hale's attorney Jesslyn Braddock told Jacobin, Daniel's initial time at the Alexandria Detention Center was tantamount to torture. After being sentenced, a judge recommended Hale be sent to a federal medical facility. First, Hale was transferred to Northern Neck Regional Jail, where he was housed in a room with 100 other inmates. When he was placed in federal custody, Hale was sent to the United States Penitentiary, Marion, in a communications management unit, that is CMU.